Calvin. Good morning, sir. It's 8 a.m. on a Sunday. How are you doing? I know you're excited to talk about this. There's nothing you'd rather be doing at 8 a.m. on a Sunday. How are you, dude?
Absolutely, man. I'm doing awesome. I know we both have kind of rigorous schedules, so I'm glad we found a time to chat.
Yeah, absolutely. And one day we'll do a in-person pod. I know we're not too far away, which is cool. That's a small world, world. I have been following you for a bit of time on social, but actually caught you first on Alan's Research Review. That's where I first just learned of your name and sought you out on social media to follow you. I'll tee you up a few times and give you your flowers. I think you're an incredibly brilliant person. I think you've written in there to the point where I think if there are other coaches out there listening, you should sign up for Alan's Research Review just for your articles, frankly. It's worth it. And so I'd love for you to give me and the listener just a little backstory of how you got to be so passionate about, let's say, human physiology and helping people get healthier and what you do now.
I mean, first of all, thank you for the kind words. That's awesome. I mean, I've always loved to write. So I've had some articles kind of stored up in the background for a while, so I'm glad they're getting out there. So in all honesty, I grew up as a bigger kid, a little bit overweight. I'd say around 13, I think it was, I decided I wanted to start losing weight. I did it kind of all wrong. You know, my main meals were rice, peanuts, and some vinaigrette. So no protein whatsoever, but I was a kid. So, it's just how it started. But about the age of 14, I developed some pretty severe IBS to the point where, it was tough to eat a lot of times. I didn't know, I never knew what was going to happen when I was going to eat. So I always had to be pretty much at my house when I was eating. I couldn't really eat out in public because, you know, who knows what would happen for me. I could have a flare up, anything of the like. And it got to the point where I got nervous to eat. It was pretty bad. Without the diagnosis of IBS, it could have been looked at as a little bit pathological. So there were times where, you know, at one point I was eating no more than once a day, sometimes even 4 or 5 times a week, just because I was so nervous to just eat in general, because I never knew how I was going to react to it. So I lost a lot of weight. I ended up kind of in and out of doctor's office for most of my childhood. I'd say between the ages of 15 to 17, I was in and out of doctor's offices. I got down to a really low body weight, about, say, 107, 108 pounds at about 5'9". So I was a pretty skinny kid. Really, through this whole time, it was during the COVID lockdown, so I had nothing to do other than to kind of make time go by. And as a brief aside, I wasn't a kid that ever had video games or a television, so the next option was reading, so I read a lot. So I started learning as much as I could, and I felt like at one point I was just accumulating knowledge without much to do with it. So once the world went back to normal, I started having conversations with people, and people, were really receptive to having these conversations. So I think at 17, I started producing some social media content, and I'm sure my first few videos got 4 or 5 views, and I was ecstatic about each and every one of those views. But it started to kind of build and build. And then at one point, I finally got an opportunity to write for Alan a while ago. The first article I wrote for him was all about cortisol. And at the time I was 18, in all honesty, he got some pushback for it about having an 18-year-old. I remember one or two people asking if he's ran out of people to write articles for him, which I'm sure might be the case. But and then kind of kept coming on. I think I'm up to 5 just articles I've written for him. And with that, I've been on a few podcasts, which is something I grew up listening to. So it's such a cool experience every time I get to be on one, especially this one, because this is one of the biggest ones I got to listen to as a kid. So kind of just doing all the things that I dreamed of doing when I was a little bit younger, it's really started to happen lately. So it's awesome. But
it's awesome.
At the moment, I'm currently 19, but I actually don't, my career isn't technically in nutrition. So people online see just the nutrition part of it. But that's kind of like 1/10 of what I actually do. I guess the real world is a bad way to put it, but I have 5 jobs at the moment. So I'm working at 3 gyms. I have a full-time job at a manufacturing facility called Caterpillar in North Carolina. And I also, on the weekends, I have a side job at a restaurant. But so I'm working a lot. I'm working 95, 100 hours every week, just kind of accumulating money right now to hopefully go to college at some point within the next few years, comfortably, you know, not going into debt, being able to not have to worry about what's happening while I'm in college. So that should come to fruition quite soon. And then hopefully any extra, I'll help out siblings with going to college and things of the like. So kind of just doing all the things in the background while trying to make this kind of nutrition thing happen online.
Do you have a field of study you'd like to go into, and maybe even ultimately like a couple of potential careers in mind?
See, I'm not certain about that. I mean, obviously nutrition is a big one, but I've always been almost much more interested in physiology than nutrition itself. So it could be more so some sort of microbiology degree. For the last few years, I've had my kind of sights set on either gene therapy or cancer research. I think those two would be just on top of this world fun, you know. So I think I've talked to a few professors so far. You know, I've heard words from them, costs, you know, what it might take. And I have a few options that I think I might go for. But if I could do cancer research in general, and then possibly blend that into some sort of actual kind of in the field therapy, if that makes any sense, then that would be you know, that would be awesome.
That's awesome, man. I mean, you're gonna do awesome at whatever you do. So give that some thought, and just I know you'll find your way. It's awesome. I wanna talk today. So today we're sitting here, we're talking about I reached out to you in response to an article you did on Allen's Research Review titled "The Fascinating Physiology of Appetite Regulation." And it was, as always, with you, incredibly thorough. You went through many different factors, neurotransmitters, hormones, the psychology of appetite, how environment impacts appetite, and incredibly, incredibly thorough. It was like 26 pages. I had to read it twice. You know, all really, really interesting stuff. And I'm gonna put a but at the end of that sentence in a way that is not a diminutive. But I thought to myself, I reached out immediately. I was like, all right, I gotta get Calvin on the podcast. We gotta talk about this. And I thought, who cares? And I thought to myself, I was like, who gives a shit about what you wrote? And what I mean is, like, who cares about it on this granular of a level? And what I mean is, like, what is, like, there are certain things that are interesting to learn about, fascinating to learn about, but ultimately, in the context of a person looking to get healthier, I think we'd both agree that, like, most people don't need to know the difference between GLP-1 and GIP and how those work, or you know, how you know, the difference between what anorexigenic or orthorexigenic means, or whatever. Like, most people don't need to think about that in their pursuit to get healthy. But I think, so there are two people who are going to be listening to this podcast. One is somebody who is actually really interested in our discussions today. We're going to talk about, you know, the hypothalamus. We're going to talk about cortisol and serotonin and dopamine and leptin and insulin and how all these things in a crazy, dynamic, intricate, symbiotic relationship affect our sensation of feeling hunger and satiety, you know, insofar as they're inversely related. And then there's gonna be another person who's like, I don't really need to know all that stuff. And I wanna speak to that person or for that person right now. And because that was my knee jerk for having you on the podcast. It wasn't, oh my God, I gotta have Calvin on here to talk about all these things intricately, because I think every person who's trying to get healthy needs to know these exact things. But I think if you are, I've had a couple of coaches I've sent this to that I work with that are either clients or whatever, and they're like, wow, this is mega complicated. And like that sentiment of this sensation of hunger is complicated. That is, if you can just sit, if you can listen, if you don't care about the exact intricate scientific stuff we're going to talk about today, if you can take home, hey, hunger is complicated. It is impacted by a diverse array of factors, again, from environment to psychology to genetics to neurotransmitters to hormones. You know, we have different baseline genetics in terms of these things. And then there's also, you know, things we do within our lives. If you can come away from this podcast with appetite is complicated, and maybe a little compassion, I think, maybe a knock-on from that is a compassion towards people who maybe have been born with less favorable genetics in terms of appetite, maybe predispose them to more calories eaten over the lifespan, people who have maybe been born into scenarios and environments that predispose them, people who have had experiences that affect them psychologically that predispose them to eating more, to having greater appetite. I think That is one thing I really want people to get from today. So we are going to go a bit, you know, we're going to try and cover a lot. I don't know what we're going to get through. We're going to try and keep it enough depth that people understand these things more than they did before they came to the podcast. But we are going to try and go wide rather than deep. But I really, and I'll shut up in a second because this, I want you to be doing 99% of the discussion today. But I just, that's a takeaway I really want people to have is, you know, this isn't, this idea of like, oh, people who have obesity and who are overweight and eat too much, this is not like, it's not that simple. Like there's a lot going on here. So maybe share a couple words on that as well. If you share that sentiment at all.
No, I definitely did. So I guess the first thing I'll say is I think I had about 14 or 15 more pages that we completely removed because it just wasn't even worth it. But I think one of the biggest things with that article was I did want it to be understood that, well, there are a few things. One, I wanted it to be understood that it is complicated. So people saying it's, you know, you'll look on social media, people being like, it's insulin, that's why you're fat. It's just so ungranular, I would say. It's just missing the boat that it's hard to even fathom like how complex it is when you hear something like that. And the other thing was that the last thing I would ever want someone to say is, oh, but you forgot about this. I've always been that way. That's part of kind of my psychology is I never want anyone to be like, but you forgot about this. So I would rather have too much and have people honestly come to me and ask questions and me be able to just explain it in kind of easier to understand ways or be on podcasts like this where we can kind of talk about it a little bit more high level and not in as much depth. But in one of those things, it's easier to have citations where you can read more about it. And I honestly, I put citations in just about everything, even things that don't even apply to the article itself. If I mention glucagon, I want to put a citation for what glucagon is, just so you can read more about it if you want to. So the last thing I want to do when I'm writing is have people tell me that I missed something or that they wish I included this. But when we're having conversations like this, we can talk about specific topics or kind of give them more generalizations, if that makes sense.
No, definitely. You are certainly the I'd rather overdo it than have missed something. And I love you for it. And you are unique in that way. And I don't change. You know, you're not on this podcast because you're like the elite at turning all this into one sentence. You're on this podcast because you're mega, mega thorough and have turn over each stone and don't leave a stone unturned. So I appreciate that. Don't change. That doesn't mean that there's never a time for, you know, disseminating information, synthesizing information and all that. You do that well too. But yeah, agreed. Let's see if we can set the scene for why it is more complicated than it sounds. What are some of the buckets that we could be discussing in terms of, hey, like, could we break this down into a few categories that impact appetite regulation?
Yes and no. So I think appetite is always for me been so difficult to define itself, like the definition of appetite. For me, it's just essentially the desire to consume. But consume isn't necessarily food. There are, as you may know, there are protein appetites, sodium appetites, water appetites. If you're anything like me, you have a caffeine appetite. And, you know, there are even things such as drug or alcohol appetites that are documented. So appetite is just the desire to consume, and it can be bucketed by a lot of things. But the best way I've kind of been able to put it in picture is that if, let's say, Jordan and I are both sitting down, we're given the access to the same food, same amount of food, and, you know, at the same times of day. Appetite is what might drive Jordan to eat 5 steaks and me to eat 1 steak. But in that, it might drive me to eat 5 servings of broccoli and Jordan to eat 1 serving of broccoli. So appetites can be for specific foods, but it also might drive a certain person to eat 5,000 calories and one person to eat 3,000 calories. So it can be defined as energy intake, specific foods, the amount of food volume. So appetite is hard to define itself because every person, even researchers, have different definitions of appetite, whether it's for food, for just consumption, whether it's for calories or for volume, for protein, things of the like. And there's all too many things that can affect appetite. So a lot of people think that your appetite is just affected by what you ate today. And that almost couldn't be further from the truth. Your appetite can be affected by your genetics, including epigenetics. So whatever happened in your mother's womb while you were being born can affect your baseline appetite. It can be affected by your body fat level, your muscle mass, how recently you worked out. How long it's been since you've slept and how long you slept when you did sleep. It can be affected by the size of your stomach, how much stretching and contracting it has gone through throughout your life. So professional eaters can eat a lot more food than you or I because they have basically trained their stomach to not respond, or essentially they have stretched their stomach so much that the amount of food that they can fit in their stomach before they feel what we would canonically refer to as full is much, much more than most people listening to this podcast. So it can be affected by so many different things, and its actual definition is tough, but that's kind of, I guess, my two cents on it.
Yeah. Let's, you know, I couldn't agree more. I think we are trying to, I don't want to be overly reductionist, but I also want to see if we can synthesize some stuff into digestible pieces. And so I think, again, I gave a 20-minute preface on, hey, this is really complicated. So I think whenever we make a slightly reductionist comment, I think we've already set the scene of like, yeah, but it's probably not that simple either. So let's dive into something we absolutely know is important in a multitude of ways. And again, ways we don't even understand fully. Let's talk about the hypothalamus. What is the hypothalamus? And how would you describe its relevance to the discussion today?
So it is kind of like it's a region in the brain that almost controls homeostasis. So it controls fluid intake, salt intake, food intake. So it can control a multitude of different things. And it does this by secreting a bunch of different molecules, hormones, neurotransmitters, neuromodulators, however you might frame them as. It secretes a multitude of different chemicals that can affect what you choose to do. And it also is affected a lot by our environment. So let's say that you haven't had water in, you know, a very long time, maybe 2 days. But you've been eating that whole time and you're extremely dehydrated. Water at that point might seem more appetizing than even just food in general because you are so deficient in water. So it really regulates kind of keeping us at homeostasis and driving our motivation and attention towards maintaining that. So if it's whether it be carbohydrate intake to maintain blood glucose or food intake to maintain body weight, protein intake, sodium, water. So it essentially is keeping us from, well, in large part passing away in some circumstances, but also maintaining a state of kind of homeostasis and baseline.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. The things that jump to mind for me in that moment are just the communication with the hypothalamus in terms of what we have currently and what we're deficient in, and the hypothalamus's role in regulating that. Like you said, homeostasis, like the presence of certain nutrients, the presence of food in general, the absence of certain food, the absence of certain nutrients, sodium, water, carbohydrates, all of that. And so that was really well said. Would you like to categorize and describe just the terminology of anorexic and orthogenic? Anorexigenic, go ahead.
Yeah, so I will say within the hypothalamus, just to caveat that is, we don't necessarily, there's some people will go all the way down to saying that if you have a magnesium deficiency, you will crave, you know, pumpkin seeds, you know, things that are high in magnesium. We can't really regulate it at that such of a granular level. But there are specific, like you might, right, like if you taste something salty and you're sodium deficient, you might really, really want to eat more and more of that. And you might see a glass of water. And because it's so easy to ascertain that water means hydration, if you are very dehydrated, you might begin to crave water. But we can't get down. It doesn't get down as granular to, you know, B12, eat steak.
Yep.
But when we're coming to, so we have anorexigenic and orexigenic. So some people might kind of hear some of the prefixes and kind of put two and two together. But anorexigenic are essentially molecules that will inhibit your appetite. And orexigenic are molecules that might stimulate your appetite. So we would say that if you are hungry, you are being dominated by orexigenic signaling. And if you are satiated and you do not have the desire to eat, you're being dominated by anorexigenic signaling. But it's like a balance, you know, at all times we'll have a little bit of orexigenic and anorexigenic signaling throughout the body. So it's kind of what signaling is dominating will dictate your food choices. Will dictate your how much you consume, but sometimes you might begin to eat foods that you really, really like, even in the absence of, you know, a lot of anorexigenic signaling. So you might be eating even when you're full because what you're eating tastes really, really good.
Yeah. And we'll get to the hyper palatable food at some point, I'm sure. Let's talk a little bit about cortisol, serotonin, and dopamine. Let's start with cortisol. And I picked those three just as like a, like you said, there's going to be things that we leave out today. But as things people have heard about, things people talk about, things people really, I'd say really misunderstand on average when it comes to social media. And when people think of cortisol, they think of stress. And when they think of stress, they think of stress impact on satiety or hunger, appetite, whatever, all of those things together. What I found most interesting about that was that cortisol seems to have both impacts. And whenever I speak on this podcast, what you're going to do is take what I just said, chew it up, and spit it back out more intelligently and appropriately. And so it seems to have both impacts in terms of reduction in appetite, but also a capacity to stimulate appetite potentially on different time scales. And so could we speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so to kind of caveat this, one of the reasons I got really interested in this was because the first article I wrote for Alan was all about cortisol and kind of misunderstanding it. And in that article, I did caveat very vaguely that some people in the state of stress will eat more and some people will eat less. So it's kind of like your appetitive response to stress differs probably depending on who you are, what type of stress it is, how long this stress has been going on. But kind of if we're looking at it simplistically, it seems that so cortisol production actually starts in that hypothalamus that we're talking about through the production of a molecule called corticotropin releasing hormone, so CRH. And then that stimulates the production of another molecule called ACTH and then finally cortisol. So it's like this three-step pathway. People refer to it as the HPA axis. It seems that CRH itself can inhibit appetite. So that initial step in cortisol production will have an appetite suppressant effect, but cortisol itself might actually have an appetite stimulant effect. So obviously I say might a lot because the research on exactly how specific hormones do specific things, it could differ between where in the body, where in the brain. But generally speaking, it has an appetite stimulatory effect. So how stress affects you kind of could depend on your balance between these two molecules, depend on your balance between the tens of other anorexigenic and orexigenic stimuli. But it seems like different stages of the stress response might alter appetite differently. So chronic long-term stress, as some people adequately put, made me gain a lot of weight, not necessarily because cortisol is going to make you store fat out of thin air, but because you're probably going to be a little hungrier, eating more emotionally. So eating foods that you like rather than foods that will nourish you. But acute short-term stress, so say, you're running away from somebody, you don't automatically just have this raging appetite while you're running away from something. That's typically you're not even thinking about food at that point. And sometimes even after exercise, when we see a large increase in cortisol, a lot of people for a multitude of reasons, one being, partly that CRH response, people have a suppressed appetite for a little bit. But some people find, and a good example would be cold plunging. So people find that after a cold plunge, they might have a suppressed appetite. We have a lot of literature indicating that for the, 24-ish hours after cold plunging, you eat more food than you would have if you hadn't cold plunged, which unfortunately for many people offsets any caloric expenditure benefit of cold plunging. And that could be because of the kind of reduction in CRH, but still elevated cortisol level that occurs after cold plunging. So initially you have a suppressant effect, and then your appetite is stimulated for kind of not the rest of the day, but for a prolonged period after that. So the stages of stress response can alter appetite differently and how long you've been in stress different types of stress.
I think that experience of stress, a lot of people will nod along with, meaning like, again, I don't want to, and anytime somebody starts a sentence with evolutionarily speaking, like, you need to be like, all right, well, maybe you don't know too much about that, but evolutionarily speaking, being chased by a tiger in that moment, it would behoove us to reduce appetite and to think about something else. And so it makes some sense in that regard that acutely we'd see you're not thinking about food in an acute stress state. But like you said, potentially more of a chronic, and again, it's how that affects your behavior. Ultimately, like you said, it might even just affect your food choices, which those choices then affect the actual amount of calories that you're going to eat based on what you ate and the macro and micronutrient of those foods and volume and all the other things. And so I find that to be, it's kind of nice when it it works out in a way that actually coincides with the experience most people would have. And I would say that that's probably when I read this section on cortisol, I was like, that makes sense to me. And that's kind of nice. A lot of times, you know, it's just way more complicated. And I'm sure it is more complicated than that. But the idea that, you know, acutely, we're going to see a reduction in appetite. Chronically, we might see an increase, a stimulation in appetite, is something that I think a lot of people, when it comes to their relationship with stress, have felt at some point. Well, I'd love to move to serotonin, which I think also had this kind of dichotomy of like sometimes excitatory, sometimes inhibitory. And so could we speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so there's only one serotonin molecule, but there's seven broad classes of serotonin receptors, and some of those receptors have different subclasses within them. So there's even more than seven, you know, serotonin receptor subclasses. So there's a bunch of different serotonin receptors, and they all signal differently within the brain. They're located in different locations of the brain, located in different locations of the body. Some of them are in the gastrointestinal tract. But different serotonin receptors have either stimulatory effects on appetite or inhibitory effects on appetite. So we can't really blanket serotonin as either or. It is essentially both. So what I would say is that this could be partly genetic, you know, predispositioning for appetite. So some people have just different abundances of serotonin receptors. And in all honesty, the way that we were raised, things that we went through as a child can alter the way our brain is structured and the abundance of different serotonin receptors throughout our brain. So kind of what high serotonin does in one person might be different than what it does in another person, depending on the type of serotonin receptors that they have. There are typically different responses to SSRIs. Off the top of my head, I wouldn't tell you which one does what, but there are different responses some people have to SSRI, prescriptions. Some people begin to gain weight and some people lose weight. And it could be just due to the abundance of serotonin receptors in their brain, which serotonin receptors that specific SSRI is stimulating, just a lot of different things. So blanketing serotonin itself as one or the other is difficult because it has different effects in different humans. So some people will take like specific testing for neurotransmitters and be like, you have high serotonin, that means this. But depending on what type of serotonin receptors you have, it might mean something completely opposite. There might be reasons why you're producing extra or not excreting enough or clearing it out of the synapse. But what serotonin does in you might be a lot different than what it does in me.
Do you, not necessarily your area of expertise, would you feel confident saying that that weight gain that one might experience on an SSRI would be caused, might be a strong word, but caused by a change in behavior due to a change in appetite and not necessarily a change to energy expenditure?
Yeah, I would plead ignorance on that one. I'm not sure, but okay. Some people... I do know, through discussion, people find that some SSRIs make them actually just more liable to kind of sit in bed all day because yep. It's almost like it makes you feel almost happy with where you're at, even if you haven't accomplished anything. So extreme serotonin, excess, some people find that, they sit on the couch all day and just watch TV and they don't really have the motivation to work or do anything else because they feel peaceful, not necessarily happy, sad, mad, upset, just they feel peaceful at what they're doing, and whether or not what they're doing is beneficial for their long-term health or well-being is kind of a different story. But some people might also go not even necessarily eat more volume of food, but choose foods with higher caloric density because they taste better. So there's a lot of different ways that it can affect you. And some people might even have diminished appetites, but still gain weight, because when we have diminished appetites, that doesn't mean our food, our caloric intake is going to be different, because we can still choose more highly caloric foods and end up still gaining weight, even though we say, hey, I have a really small appetite. I don't eat much. But when I do eat, it's a big glass of orange juice, a caramel macchiato, some stuff like that.
Yeah. You could even make you could if you wanted, where like if the smaller your appetite, the likelihood that you would lean towards something more hyper palatable might be there. But we can go into that another time. I want to move to dopamine. Dopamine was another one that I felt People will nod along with the dichotomy here of dopamine being something that could inhibit food seeking behavior and something that could literally be caused by the anticipation of eating something yummy, and cause you to maybe, you know, in some sort of feedback loop, maybe eat more. So let's speak to that a little bit. Tell me about how, let's talk about the dopamine in that is released in the anticipation of consuming, you know, something yummy. And then we could talk about how it might be in other contexts, something that could inhibit food seeking behavior.
Yeah, so dopamine is something I've been kind of obsessed with for a while because I wrote a big senior thesis on dopamine and how it can affect food intake. So dopamine is kind of mischaracterized sometimes. People see dopamine, they say, I eat chocolate, I get dopamine, where it's kind of like too simplistic and not actually necessarily correct in a sense. So dopamine actually appears to drive motivational behavior. So you would look at, maybe you would smell something that tastes good. That would actually cause a surge or an increase in dopamine production. And that increase in dopamine would drive you to essentially go out and find whatever that food is that smells really good. But dopamine itself can, there's one dopamine molecule, but it can drive hundreds of different behaviors. So the motivation that it, what your motivational path is dictated largely by your environment. So in the article I wrote, essentially dopamine, a lot of times we release dopamine in response to food. And someone who has kind of a relationship with food and making them feel better, they're, you know, more likely to seek food when they have high dopamine, if that makes sense. But dopamine also drives drug addictions and addictive behaviors. So let's say if we take it's a kind of a vulgar representation, but it's very representative. A cocaine addict often has, they're known for having quite a small body weight. Typically they don't eat very much because cocaine is one of the most dopaminergic substances on the planet. So it will essentially cause this large increase in dopamine, and all that dopamine is centered on the acquisition and ingestion of cocaine, but not on the acquisition and ingestion of food. So these people kind of neglect the consumption of food, and they end up losing weight. So this dopamine, we could technically say, is orexigenic for cocaine and anorexigenic for food. So it can drive both the ingestion and the seeking and ingestion of food through motivational behavior, but it can also essentially turn your attention completely 180 to something completely different. And you might forget to eat for days at a time, depending on whatever that stimuli might be.
Yeah, I think that there's that idea of, well, I think dopamine now is getting some sort of a bad rap based on just, again, if the dopamine release in anticipation of hyperpalatable food. It's a thing that you're using to make yourself feel better, but could also be, like you said, anorexigenic, meaning if you, I don't know, I'm thinking of like these clips that have went around over the years of like Beyonce saying that she was like in the studio making her next album. She's like, I forgot to eat for a day and a half. And it's like, yeah, because she was like so focused on this goal, that very goal-oriented behavior towards this one thing, and not necessarily, oh, you're all hopped up on dopamine, doesn't mean you're eating all this food, because it is almost like task, or not task specific, but if whatever the object of your motivation is, will reinforce that thing. Is that fair?
Yeah, I would say like in that circumstance, so a hyper dopaminergic state would be just high levels of dopamine above baseline. In her sense, she had that, but it was, again, a center towards something completely different. But in the setting of binge eating, that's also a hyper dopaminergic state. That's a tough word to say for me. And that's basically centered on the acquisition and consumption of typically tasty, hyper palatable foods. So it's basically there's motivational behavior is driven almost entirely by this one molecule. That's simplistic, obviously, but driven in large part by this one molecule. But what that motivational behavior is can be wildly different depending on the context, the person, your history. Because if you have this connection of going right towards food when you feel kind of sad or unhappy, then that might be the first thing that happens when you, when you feel sad or unhappy. And that would be driven, again, by dopamine. But if when you feel sad or unhappy, you typically go watch your favorite television show, and watch it for 5 hours and don't eat anything, then again, that might be something that happens, and they're both driven by high levels of dopamine.
Are those behaviors reinforced, right? Is this something that, and again, if you're like, hey, this is not my area of expertise, we can pivot, but is that behavior reinforced by doing it in that moment? So let's say you are the person who, let's say binge eating or watching your favorite TV show or whatever other behavior that you do as a coping mechanism emotionally. Is that behavior reinforced by doing it and by having it almost fix the problem in some ways, right? And it's like, okay, that worked, that made me feel good. And is that now a pathway that has been reinforced and I'm more likely to make that decision again in the future? And is it retrainable? Like, is there a way of, yeah, I can do other behaviors and I can start to build a reinforcement with that new behavior when I don't feel good?
I'd say yes and no. So dopamine kind of acts on something we refer to as a reward prediction error. So essentially, let's say something bad happens and you predict that eating a chocolate bar will make you feel better. But after eating that chocolate bar, maybe in the midst of eating that chocolate bar, you drop it on the ground and, you know, you feel terrible. And, you know, you release more dopamine than the actual gratification of the event elicits, if that makes sense. So you predicted that event to be more gratifying than it actually was. That could actually almost break a habit loop because your brain begins to almost disassociate the actual pleasure. Right.
It didn't work. Yeah.
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 And, you know, if you, let's say you tell a kid you're going to take them to the amusement park and they have this large dopamine release, and then you get to the amusement park and it's closed. Even though the amusement park might be super, super fun, at that point, their correlation with the amusement park and enjoyment almost is diminished because of that one experience. So there's a lot of, like, it's very complex. I would say, you know, I'd probably plead ignorance on this one again, but it's complex, but there definitely are ways to change it. So like I said, you know, it's this one molecule that drives a lot of different behaviors. So if you can find a behavior that matches the power of the previous stimuli, then you might be able to kind of achieve the same result with a different set of behaviors.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is, I mean, using food as a coping mechanism, using food as something that makes you feel good and, you know, at face value outside of any other context, we can't say is always a bad thing, but on average, unlikely to be the most healthful coping mechanism. Let's talk a little bit about leptin, and I say a little bit almost tongue in cheek because we could talk about it all day. And I know you did another article on leptin resistance. And even if we stood on leptin and talked for the next half hour on it, I'd be super happy because I think it's probably one of the places I suspect we could go deeper. And so let's do broad brushstroke, zoomed out, what is leptin, and then maybe work our way towards a discussion on leptin resistance.
Yeah, so leptin is basically a molecule secreted by your fat cells in proportion to their size. So the larger a fat cell gets, the more leptin it produces. And the leptin is canonically referred to as an anorexigenic molecule. So it essentially inhibits appetite. So it will bind to receptors in the brain and kind of prevent you from eating more food. And it also works a lot on baseline appetite. So kind of just your appetite between meals, during meals, things of the like. But there are differences in the type of fat that we store will differ in how much leptin we produce. So it appears that women produce, one of the reasons women have lower appetite than men is because they produce more leptin, and even at the same given level of body fat. And the reason is because estrogens have kind of a, so let me frame this. Fat cells can grow via hyperplasia or hypertrophy. Hypertrophy is when a single fat cell gets bigger. Hyperplasia is when you store, you know, a given amount of fat in multiple different fat cells. So hypertrophy, kind of estrogens drive hyperplasia of subcutaneous fat tissue, which is essentially that some people consider unsightly fat right underneath the skin. But that process appears to increase their production of leptin. But androgens in men appear to drive hypertrophy of visceral fat. So essentially fat surrounding and inundated the organs. So essentially, because of the specific level of hormones that men and women have in their body, and the way that their body fat grows, different sexes have different levels of leptin at the same given level of body fat. And it's not just driven by sex. It can be driven by genetics. So certain cultures have a greater expansion of visceral fat than subcutaneous fat, and vice versa. So where you store your fat has a large impact on the production of leptin at the same given level of body fat.
So when somebody gains body fat, what is, and again, correct slash reiterate if needed, what's usually happening, at least for the most part, is that fat cells are growing in size. You're not creating new fat cells, not always. And I'd love for you to say when that can happen, because that can happen. But is that correct in saying, okay, if you gained weight, it's not that you gained more fat cells. For the most part, the fat cells that you have had for the most part of your life have now grown in size.
Yes. So I would say for the most part, that's pretty much accurate. It depends on stage of life also. So kid versus adult. And it depends on, so there's even like certain dietary factors that can promote hyperplasia, maybe not to the most extreme degree, but to a short, a small degree. And certain medications that people are on can also promote hyperplasia. So GLP-1 agonists, people have kind of run with the idea that they give you more fat cells. And in the grand scheme of things, this is something that actually improves insulin sensitivity and is a healthier way to store fat with more fat cells rather than enlarged fat cells. So GLP-1 agonists can do such a thing. There are specific diabetes medications that also essentially promote fat cell hyperplasia, which once again promotes insulin sensitivity. So if we look at it, you're going to store the same amount of fat, what we do, based on your caloric intake, but hyperplasia of fat cells would actually be considered, better for you and your long-term health and hypertrophy. But there's not much we can really do to alter how our fat cells expand, other than kind of just living a healthier lifestyle, just ends up promoting, kind of erring on the side of hyperplasia, but not to a massive extent.
Gotcha. So here's kind of what should happen based on what we just said, which is as you eat in a calorie surplus, for the most part, you were seeing fat cell hypertrophy and the fat cells are growing larger. And as they grow larger, they secrete more leptin. And that leptin should make you feel more satiated, which should make you eat less, which should, again, in the pursuit of homeostasis, should keep you from gaining, a certain, beyond a certain point, or motivate you over time to eat less and hopefully, at some point, maintain where you're at. Why is that not happening to people, some people, people in general?
Yeah. So we would think that people who are the most overweight would have the lowest appetites, basically. But that would kind of, it's contrary to what we've been seeing lately, is just increasing body sizes. And the reason is, as much as it's a bit of a buzzword, it is a real phenomenon called leptin resistance. Essentially, when the brain is no longer responding to high circulating levels of leptin as we would expect it to. And one of the biggest reasons is because leptin itself exhibits what's called homologous desensitization. Essentially, when it binds to its receptor, it makes whatever that neuron is less likely to express that receptor in the future. So high levels of leptin itself reduces the amount of leptin receptors available to the brain. There's also kind of the transport of leptin into the brain is considered a saturatable process. So there's only so many transporters of leptin from the bloodstream into the brain. And once you've hit that maximum, you're not going to transport any more leptin despite having exceedingly higher and higher levels of leptin. So at some point, there's just a cutoff of how much leptin you can actually push into the brain. And what its actual effects are on the brain begins to diminish the more and more leptin you are producing. So
is that confounded in some way by other issues that are likely happening alongside? So if you're somebody who is producing more leptin, you are presumably in a larger body, and presumably with extra body fat, we're seeing other metabolic dysregulation, we're seeing chronic inflammation, we're seeing, increase in blood sugar, we're seeing inflammatory markers, everything, metabolic dysregulation across the board. Is that a confounder? I mean, what it sounds like you're saying is more leptin should be anorexigenic, should cause people to eat less, but we're not seeing that because basically, like, the more leptin you're producing, the less it's working in some ways. Is that confounded in some ways by, yeah, but also because people who are producing the most leptin are also potentially on average, less healthy in other ways?
Yeah, so there's multiple different mechanisms for leptin resistance. You know, that homologous desensitization is one of them. Others include there's a correlation between insulin resistance and leptin resistance. I think there's kind of a paucity of literature on that subject specifically, what causes what, how what causes what. But there's definitely a correlation between, you know, insulin resistance and leptin resistance, which is one of the many reasons why people with diabetes typically have what they refer to as hyperphagia, which is just like kind of an excessively high appetite. But there's so many reasons for that. Inflammatory cytokines, so these molecules produced by immune cells in response to inflammation. Essentially, when our fat cells get really, really large, there's multiple reasons why they begin to produce more inflammatory cytokines, one of which is that they get so large that they get farther and farther away from the blood supply, and they get what's called hypoxic, so they lack oxygen. And the response to hypoxia is the production of inflammatory cytokines. And these inflammatory cytokines can also inhibit leptin signaling within the brain and its transport into the brain. So there's multiple different factors, but they all kind of coincide to this one phenotype, which is typically an overweight person with expanded fat cells. And it could be, we see also visceral fat is a little bit more inflammatory than subcutaneous fat. So higher visceral fat levels can also be a part of this kind of leptin resistant phenotype.
So I'd love for you to explain why. So it's my understanding, again, I'm a bit reductionist, but for the sake of a chuckle and then an explanation, you know, I'm imagining people discovering leptin and its role in satiety and thinking like, hey, man, the people, like you said, the people who are overweight must not be producing enough leptin, right? They must just not be producing enough leptin. So if we just inject them with leptin, you know, like we do with other hormones, you know, they'll feel more full. And why isn't that happening? And what does that tell us? Or why did that not work when we did these trials? And what does that tell us?
Yeah, at one point leptin was, when it was essentially discovered, we thought we found the miracle cure to obesity. So we started doing experiments on leptin injections, and it either at best made no difference, at worst actually sometimes made the problem worse. And again, it's due to this kind of, not all hormones work in this way. So some people will reductionize specific hormones to this. So they say that high levels of insulin causes insulin resistance, and that's a little bit overly reductionist. But leptin itself does, like there's one article that I think I included in the paper. It basically said high level of or hyperleptinemia is required for leptin resistance. It's essentially this process of having excessive amounts of leptin is one of the main driving factors of leptin resistance. So just putting in more will kind of exacerbate the issue over time. And, you know, if you're, let's say you're not responding to, or you're not even able to transport more leptin into the brain, putting more in the bloodstream, you know, inside of your kind of, you know, in the blood supply to your brain won't have really much of an effect at all, because this process is saturatable. So you're not going to transport, you're not just going to magically push more leptin into the brain if you put more leptin into the bloodstream.
How can we improve leptin sensitivity? What are things we can do to enhance its signaling?
It seems like low energy availability at specific points of the day are kind of important for improving it. So this could be exercise itself, caloric restriction, things that will put you into a low energy state periodically, things that reduce inflammation as well. But, you know, again, there's a lot of things in the article where there's not as much literature as I would love on the topic, but that's where the best literature lies. Obviously, you know, losing body fat, so reducing leptin production, getting into a kind of a low energy state, because the specific molecules that are upregulated in that state can help to improve leptin sensitivity. Same with basically the sensitivity to most hormones like insulin. So putting yourself into a low energy state, if you have some sort of inflammatory process going on, which could be a lot of different things, including, you know, injuries or even just things that are correlated with, you know, chronic diseases. If you have some sort of inflammatory process going on, trying to rectify that could also be important. But really, it's kind of just putting yourself into if it's caused by being overweight and obese, it would just be kind of rectifying the main underlying issue.
Yeah, it's a boring, hey, the things that make you a healthier person overall are both improving this, which also will improve your ability to get and stay healthier as well. You know, there's articles that look at long-term. So somebody will, this is a whole, the whole basis of today's conversation. But when it comes to exercise, we talked briefly about how it can acutely reduce appetite, increasing cortisol and other. And again, I don't, you know, don't want to be overly reductionist and say it's just that. But it seems that exercise can regulate appetite over the longer term. And I would posit gently that this is probably one of the ways it does that.
Yeah, I think, you know, there are some studies that look at the differences between completely sedentary people, moderately active people, and very active people. And on average, the people that are sedentary eat just as much, if not more, than the moderately and highly active people, plausibly, you know, most likely because of the ways that it can alter our different, you know, different complex milieu of hormones and neurotransmitters that will alter our appetite. So it seems that if anything, appetite can, so exercise seems to kind of uncouple and recouple appetite with energy expenditure. So let's say you burn 500 calories during exercise, you might eat 300 calories more just because of that, you know, that increased energy expenditure, but there's still a 200 calorie discrepancy there, meaning that in itself is uncoupled, but there's still a coupling of, you know, you did activity, so you will eat a little bit more. So there's kind of a process by which you most likely will eat a little bit more, but typically it's not enough to counterbalance the energy expenditure through exercise or just physical activity in general. So getting, you know, a certain amount of steps during the day, doing a physically demanding job, those things will help to regulate energy intake with energy expenditure a little bit better.
What is that study with the workers?
I believe it might be in the article. I'm not entirely sure, but okay. I can't off the top of my head remember the title.
Yeah, essentially they looked at how much people they were doing some sort of manual labor, and it was the ones that were, they looked at how much people were eating, and the sedentary people were eating just as much as the people that were the most active, and of course that being a less favorable scenario, and pointing to some sort of, like you said, some sort of regulation between activity and appetite to the point where they are more likely to match one another, which would be a favorable favorable outcome. So yeah, I'm browsing in the background to just Googling random words, but I know that that's a study that they looked at. Why do I think that it was in India? I could totally be making that up, but there is a study on that. If I find it, I'll put it in the show notes. Amazing.
Yeah,
let's keep it moving. Anything else on leptin before we move on?
Not really. I would say that, you know, again, leptin has become a bit of a buzzword, like insulin and other things on the internet. So I would say if you hear things about leptin that sound interesting, but maybe not all too correct, just do some of your own research on, I'd say you and I both will say credible sites would be something like PubMed, and just try and fact check some of the things you hear on the internet if possible, because as it becomes a buzzword, there's more and more misinformation spouted about on the internet.
Yes, agreed. Let's talk a little bit about, and again, we're coming up on an hour. We're gonna go over the hour, but I'm trying to think the things we have left. This might be our biggest one. I want to get through this and maybe ketosis as well. We have insulin and blood sugar right now. Yeah, let's talk about that because I think so. Let's talk about insulin and blood sugar. And again, speaking of buzzwords, there are few as great as these. I don't want to jump down the throat of the, you know, low-carb community's claims around insulin spikes causing greater hunger, but I suspect we'll end up there. Let's just do brief physiology of insulin and blood sugar, and then maybe make our way over to the discussion of whether or not insulin is an appetite suppressant or something that causes greater appetite.
Yeah, so essentially, you know, you eat food and it isn't necessarily carbohydrates. It could be a very lean protein like white fish can also be referred to as insulinogenic, meaning it causes quite a large rise in insulin. But just food other than if you're eating a stick of butter will cause an increase in blood glucose. And in response, as blood glucose is always shuttling in and out of the pancreas detects this elevation in blood glucose, essentially because this glucose increases the production of energy in the pancreas, and this causes it to evict insulin into the bloodstream. And insulin will bind to a multitude of different places in the body, almost every cell in the body, and do different things. But one of its most canonical effects is just lowering blood glucose. So it allows cells to uptake glucose that wouldn't normally be uptaking glucose out of the bloodstream. So mainly the muscles, because we try and preserve as much glucose in the bloodstream as possible, because certain cells in the body require glucose. They cannot use fatty acids. They can use ketones either to a minor extent or to no extent at all. So they require blood glucose, and they're pretty much the most important cells within the body. A lot of them are in the brain, which is why extremely low blood glucose would essentially cause you to black out, because your brain needs a glucose supply. So if we don't have high blood glucose, certain cells in the body that can use fatty acids and other molecules will not uptake glucose out of the bloodstream to any meaningful extent, because we're trying to preserve that glucose for the brain. But if we have elevated blood glucose, there are mechanisms to get that glucose out of the bloodstream, which would be storing it in the muscles, the liver, increasing glucose uptake in the brain, in different places throughout the body. And eventually, at some point, if there's so much glucose around, we can also increase the production of fat. But that's so minor, you'd have to eat thousands of grams of glucose, that the idea is that any glucose spike will automatically cause fat storage is a little bit oversimplistic.
Absolutely. And likely impractical and not what's happening. The amount of nails in the coffin of the carbohydrate insulin model of obesity, this idea that, like you just said, that you eat carbs, insulin goes up, insulin, inhibits lipolysis, increases fat storage, whatever sorts of, and I call them buzzwords because those things might be technically true, but practically don't lead to a net increase in body fat over time, because that you need an energy surplus for that. There's so many nails in that coffin, but in the last, 2 to 5 years, the introduction of GLP-1 medications, and I know we're going to get to them in a second. That's our next, that's our next section here. But one of the things that these drugs, these GLP-1 drugs, whether you're talking about semaglutide or tirzepatide, one of the things they do is they stimulate insulin production. And if that was causing people to get fat, I promise you, people would not be doing what they're doing, which is losing a ton of weight on these drugs. And so, is that something that you, in your head, chuckle about? And what does that kind of tell us about insulin's role here on satiety?
A little bit. So GLP-1 itself has receptors in the brain that are also appetite suppressant. But it makes me chuckle a little bit because there's a few videos, a lot of videos coming out now about insulin makes you hungry. And it kind of is exactly the opposite. So insulin itself binds to receptors in the brain that will stop you from eating. Basically, it's an anorexigenic molecule. So it's considered catabolic on appetite. So it will reduce your energy intake for the extent that insulin is elevated. There's a lot of, fear-mongering is the best word, that all insulin increases will lead to reactive hypoglycemia. So essentially people will frame it on the internet that anytime your glucose elevates, it comes crashing down like a roller coaster, and we have no regulatory hormones to counterbalance that. We have far too many hormones to counteract low blood glucose. We have much more than those that counteract high blood glucose. There are different accesses of keeping blood glucose in range, that as blood glucose begins to decrease, hormones that maintain blood glucose begin to increase. And after a very large, high carbohydrate meal, unless you have blood glucose conservation issues, most of the literature indicates that there is no, sudden reactive hypoglycemia every time you eat carbohydrates, if that makes sense. But sometimes it's framed that insulin itself causes this reactive hypoglycemia process. So people will kind of maybe take a step back, move the goalpost a little bit, and say, I didn't mean insulin. I meant that, insulin causes hypoglycemia. And even that in itself doesn't really have much, if any, literature behind it. Obviously, there are reasons that lower glycemic carbohydrate foods are more satiating, typically due to just a higher fiber content, higher complex carbohydrate content, but it isn't necessarily because of some magic with insulin and blood glucose, if that makes sense.
No, definitely. And I think if insulin was orexigenic, then we probably wouldn't see some of or most of the highest ranking foods in terms of satiety be carbohydrates? I know, you know, I know people talk, and I have said, and probably will continue to say that that protein is a really, on average, a satiating macronutrient. That I think that that's probably missaid. I think higher protein diets on average are probably more satiating is a more appropriate way I would frame that, because if you look at a satiety index, a lot of the highest ranking, and some of them are protein too, but a lot of the highest ranking foods are carbohydrates. So we're talking about potatoes, oranges, apples, oatmeal. They rank just as high, if not higher, than protein. And yeah, whitefish and some other like poultry are going to rank really high, but you know, if insulin was causing people to be really hungry, then it would be pretty paradoxical that the foods that are ranked as the most satiating are also at the same time carbohydrates.
Yeah, I think if we basically line up the insulin index and the so it's tough because people will point at foods that are very high in both carbohydrates and fat. And because fat does basically increase the amount of insulin that you need to get a given bolus of glucose down, you know, back to baseline. Some foods that are high in fat and glucose, which are appetite stimulatory for different reasons other than glucose or other than insulin, people will point at those and be like, but what about these? So on average, let's say you just ate a food that basically just has carbohydrates in it, like a white potato, very high on the insulin index and in a lot of, you know, a lot of research on it, very high in the satiety index, if not the highest. So there's going to be discrepancies based off of so many different factors inside of a food. So again, like trying to simplify it down to insulin this, glucose that is so difficult because there's so many different factors of food, including taste. Honestly, if you had access to it when you were a kid, there's so many different things that can alter this. But on average, we can't say that it really has any stimulatory effect on appetite. Rather, it's more than likely going to suppress appetite.
Yep. Agreed.
And
agreed.
But I will also caveat that type 1 diabetics, before they get treated, one of the biggest symptoms of type 1 diabetes is also hyperphagia. So just an excessive appetite because while simultaneously having very high blood glucose, you know, either when they're not getting their insulin dosages correct or before they get diagnosed with diabetes. So on the onset of type 1 diabetes, which can occur later in life, people, find these symptoms, and one includes being excessively hungry. And that is one of the kind of deciding factors to test for type 1 diabetes.
Is another one being excessively thirsty?
Yes, sir.
Do you know why that is?
Insulin does a lot for retaining water and electrolytes at the kidneys. So absence of insulin means kidneys excrete a lot more sodium and water. So if you're urinating a lot, you're also very, very thirsty. And high blood glucose increases the osmolarity of the blood, which is also a feedback mechanism in the brain to increase fluid intake. So same way that an extremely salty meal, even if you have the same amount of water as a very, you know, low sodium meal, will also increase thirst just because there are more solutes in the bloodstream than the adequate amount of water.
Super cool. Super cool. Anything else we want to talk that you find is pertinent on insulin and blood glucose when it comes to appetite regulation?
I'd say people might conflate insulin resistance with insulin because insulin resistance kind of does the exact opposite of insulin, where it might stimulate appetite. So again, hyperphagia is another kind of symptom of insulin resistance. But again, insulin and insulin resistance are not really the same thing whatsoever. And saying that insulin itself leads to insulin resistance is also very overly simplistic.
Yeah. Most certainly, this idea that having insulin spikes. First of all, whoever was the first person to use the word spike just fucked all of us, because it is a word that comes with a negative connotation. It sounds bad. This idea that insulin spikes will ultimately lead to insulin resistance, totally just have an entire podcast on that. Not a thing. I also feel like it's just reductionist and myopic to think. I just think people who are insulin resistant on average probably are also on average metabolically less healthy and have other things going on. And to say that, oh, it's the insulin resistance, it's like, well, is it the insulin resistance? Is it the chronic inflammation? Is it a multitude of, is it the fact that that person might also be sedentary? I mean, there's so many things going on. Yeah, there are people who have insulin resistance and lack some of those other things, for sure, for sure. But on average, I feel like these are part of a package deal of metabolic unhealth.
Yeah, it's talk to the leading researchers on insulin resistance. They've, you know, when they conduct studies, they say the only normal weight people that they can find with insulin resistance must be sedentary. There's almost no other way other besides some genetic abnormality for someone to be insulin resistant and at a normal body fat unless they are completely sedentary and very low muscle mass.
Interesting, interesting. Which would point to exercise and you know, whether that's cardiovascular exercise or maybe in this, maybe even more powerfully, resistance exercise, building muscle, being super duper powerful. Excellent. Let's talk about gut hormones. Man, another entire podcast could be done here. Let's do a brief overview. I don't know if you want to speak to where these things are within the, where they are secreted along the digestive tract. How would you go about describing? And I wrote down four of them, but there are more. There are plenty more. But let's set the stage for how these gut hormones impact our satiety.
Yeah, I'd say these might be more of the more tangible ones that we can think about when it comes to the dietary front. Yeah. Because we have a few different ones, GLP-1, GIP, CCK, PYY. There's a lot of different ones that are basically secreted when food particles interact with the cells that produce them. And this gets kind of important. So one of the probably the best research one would end up being GLP-1. And the cells that produce GLP-1 are located much farther down in the intestinal tract than the cells that produce something like GIP. So they're located at the bottom portion of the small intestine, closer to the large intestine. And this becomes important when it comes to the speed of digestion of food and the complexity of that food, as well as all those bacteria in the large intestine. So if we think about it, the foods that are the most rapidly digested, so very simple carbohydrates, so you know maybe something such as a candy bar, doesn't produce that much of a GLP-1 response, despite its caloric load, because it's very, very rapidly basically digested and absorbed in the upper portion of the small intestine. It might induce a large GIP response, but that doesn't have as much literature behind it as the GLP-1 response for appetite suppressant. So foods that take longer to digest and make it farther down the gastrointestinal tract end up producing a higher GLP-1 production. So whole grain bread compared to white bread, complex carbohydrates compared to simple carbohydrates, things with more fiber in them compared to less fibrous options, because fiber almost pulls food with it down the intestinal tract. It makes it more difficult for digestive enzymes to access it until that lower portion. And with that, we also see that the short chain fatty acids produced in the gut microbiome in response to dietary fiber ingestion also stimulate GLP-1 production. So it's essentially those more complex foods that are more difficult to fully digest, and you probably know what those are just thinking about it. So a piece of red meat would probably be a little bit harder to digest than like a protein shake. Interestingly, a protein shake's interesting because it does elicit a large GLP-1 response, but it's very rapid and it doesn't last very long, whereas other things might induce a less rapid but more prolonged GLP-1 response. So even just, you know, a full piece of steak compared to ground meat might end up producing, on average, would likely produce more GLP-1 with that more whole piece of meat compared to ground up meat, just because of that digestive process. But, you know, complex carbohydrates, things like that would, and as much as most people don't want to hear it, polyunsaturated fats produce more GLP-1 than saturated fats on average. And then the longer the chain length, but that's just getting so nuanced that it's a little bit too much.
So foods that digest more slowly and foods that make it further down the digestive tract likely are going to lead to secretion of specifically a little bit more GLP-1, maybe a little bit more PYY, but and that in turn is one of the reasons that those foods are in fact more satiating, is because they're making it further down the digestive tract and aiding causing in the release of a greater amount of these hormones. Correct? Incorrect?
Yeah, I mean, again, like we talked about, there's other reasons.
Yes.
They might stay in the stomach longer, and
yep.
You know, that stomach distension also is part of the satiety response. As you might know, if you drink a bunch of water, you feel a little bit satiated for a minute or two until that's, you know, maybe a little bit longer than that. So things that stay in the stomach for longer, stay in the intestinal tract for longer, just end up being a little bit more satiating on average. Yep. On average, though.
Yep. Yep. And we'll get to mechanoreceptors probably right at the end here. While we're here, let's talk about, I mean, we've had discussions. I've had people on the podcast. I've had Carl Nadolski on to talk about, you know, semaglutide, tirzepatide. But I think while we're here, I think it's important. Semaglutide, you know, Wegovy, Ozempic, brand names, is a GLP-1 agonist. And tirzepatide, now Mounjaro and Zepbound, is a GLP-1 agonist and a GIP agonist. And seems to be producing greater results in terms of reduction in type 2 diabetes, in weight, and, you know, also a cool thing with less negative side effects, which, yeah, okay, I don't know necessarily we can speak to why that might be, but could we talk a little bit about the difference between GLP and GIP and maybe in regards to weight loss medications?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, I think Carl is probably the expert on these, but
sure.
Because of the way that they alter glucagon differently, there's a different glycemic response to them. And because both hormones have appetite suppressant effects, if you combine the two, you can probably use a little bit less GLP-1 with a little bit of GIP and get some of the, you know, reduce some of the negative effects from excessive GLP-1, and, you know, kind of like finding that happy medium between all of them. There's even triple agonists now, which also, I believe they're stimulating glucagon production. So there's a lot of different new medications, and, you know, they're kind of more closely mimicking what happens in response to a meal, a little bit better than just giving GLP-1 itself. And in all honesty, I think there's a lot of backlash for these medications that is almost undeserved. Obviously, there's a different response to an injection of a molecule that's like chronic, stays in the bloodstream for a longer time compared to, you know, the response that occurs after a meal. But some of the, you know, extreme fear monitoring behind these medications is a little bit undeserved, especially as we see they have a lot more effects just than suppressing appetite a little bit. This includes some of them are looking at reducing drug addictive behaviors. So alcohol, you know, other drugs of abuse, helping with cognitive function, other things like that, reducing inflammation. There's just so many things that they're doing besides just making you eat less, allowing you to lose weight, that I think they are powerful, but they need to be managed by, like, essentially the right practitioner, manager, just deciding what's the best for you. Is it just a sole GLP-1 agonist, the GLP-GIP, a triple agonist, something of the like. So there's going to be a lot more research on it. I mean, there's no stopping them. They're just becoming so big that if you don't begin to look into them now, you might end up a little bit behind.
Yes, agreed. And there's, like with everything, I just got a bunch of questions recently in Q&As about micro-dosing these in a Jira-protective way, in like a proactive way, in terms of like the classic biohack, I'm going to microdose this thing even though I'm healthy because I think it's going to have long-term effects. And I think that that's like already healthy people microdosing this stuff in the hopes that there is some sort of longevity benefit is a painful, I mean, you can't see my eyes right now because this isn't up on YouTube, but a painful sort of like eyebrow raise biohack thing. Have you heard about this at all?
So I know there's a little bit of literature behind it. I haven't, you know, I'm not too much into those spheres. I'd say that there's potential for it, obviously. But if you're already healthy, I can't tell you what it's going to do. Obviously, we know that being frail when you get older and older isn't necessarily a good thing. But there is also so a lot of the negative hate around them is that they might increase muscle mass loss. But if we look at the actions of GLP-1 specifically, in the skeletal muscle, it increases protein synthesis. So it's helpful for the preservation of lean muscle mass. But this is a very simplistic GLP-1 binds to skeletal muscle. If we look at its overarching effect, it typically decreases caloric and protein intake, which is one of the reasons people begin to lose more muscle mass, more than normal. But there's some literature on it looking at GLP-1s for sarcopenia itself. But it's the biggest caveat is we have to manage its effects on muscle protein synthesis with its effects on appetite.
Yes.
So it really just depends on the overall outcome. If it makes you very frail, then I can't tell you it's going to be a good thing. But if it helps to reduce some of that age-related muscle loss, age-related inflammation, there's some sort of neuroprotective effect, but how exactly that is, what exactly that is, how important that is, again, needs more research, but there's potential for it, but I'd say we don't know the side effects.
Yeah, that's fair and well said and well caveated. Let's talk about just the presence of food. Let's talk about mechanoreceptors in the stomach, stress receptors. I think people have, like you had mentioned before, I've heard this sort of stuff. Like people talk about volume eating and just the act of that food having greater volume, independent of calories and micro and macronutrients, the actual volume of the food being an independent factor in satiety. And so could we speak to that a little bit?
Yes, there's a bit of a difference between kind of vernacular satiety and satiation. Satiety is stopping eating at a given meal. Satiation is the fullness you perceive between meals. So the effect of like, I ate and now I don't want to eat more, a lot of that is driven by gastric volume, because that's really by the time that you stop eating, that's really as far as the food makes it. And gastric volume isn't necessarily just food. It can be a lot of things. It can be water. So let's say you had, you know, a liter of water prior to a meal, you'd probably end up eating less in that meal. There are interesting weight loss strategies around that. Whether those be good or be bad is kind of a different discussion, but that's something that, you know, in water preload studies, they look at, they see decreased caloric intake. But other preload studies include a low calorie density soup that also fills up a gastric volume, just a low calorie density salad decreases caloric intake in that meal. Even so, you think about it, it's either adding 150 calories of salad or nothing. That 150 calories still reduces overall caloric intake in that meal, meaning that they eat at least more than 150 calories less in that given meal, if that makes sense. So there are strategies around filling up gastric volume to essentially allow you to stop eating at a given meal. And because the satiation response is a little bit more prolonged than the satiety response, if you can get earlier meal satiety for the goal of losing weight, then by the time that, you know, you even think about eating again, that satiation response might hit and you're a little less hungry to even go out and seek food again, if that makes sense.
It totally does. Just to reiterate, just like there are studies where, you know, people have water, a certain amount of water before they eat, and another group doesn't, and that reduces the amount that group eats. And you even said that, okay, that's water, that's you know, and doesn't have any calories. But there are even studies where people have, like you said, a low calorie salad or a low calorie soup that has calories, and it still creates a net reduction in the calories eaten at that entire meal due to that, you know, preload of volume, that stimulus to the body that there's something in you. Probably doesn't work that way with like bread, and it probably works the exact opposite with bread and butter at restaurants. But if we're talking about like a soup or a low calorie salad or a large glass of water, those are real things, real low cost things you can do to increase the satiety of a meal. And, you know, overall, if the goal is a reduction in calories over time, do that pretty practically.
And I say, like, as much hate as they get, the, you know, non-caloric beverages, so artificial sweetened beverages, like diet soda or something of the like, we see that they also reduce caloric intake, whether it be because it's replacing stomach volume for higher caloric options. Also effects on, they do studies where they compare them to water and see that on average, people lose more weight consuming them compared to water, most likely due to some sort of satiating or sweet tooth curbing response for the artificial sweeteners. So there's also, as much as people hate it because it doesn't feel natural, I think non-nutritive sweetened beverages also have efficacy in something like this to reduce caloric intake if that is the overall goal, and also make dieting a little easier.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like I hope the people listening to this podcast are nodding along with you there, and that you didn't say anything contentious just now. This idea that a non-nutritive sweetener, a diet soda, in any amount that humans would reasonably consume it, is going to be, for most people, a net negative is highly unlikely. I think you and I would both agree that, hey, an individual's response to this is what's most important. But on average, this idea that diet soda is worse than its full sugar version, or that it's inherently bad by just in general, not even compared to its full sugar self, is, again, wildly unfounded when we look at the research. Just not true. It outperforms water in terms of, you know, weight loss. And nobody is saying trade out your water for diet soda. But what we are saying is that there's utility to this in some way, for sure.
Yeah, I think again, people hear that and they think that we should drink gallons of diet soda a day just to replace water. But that's not necessarily what, you know, obviously anyone's talking about. Also, I think there are mechanisms that any single given substance that you put in your body can be detrimental. There are reasons why certain amino acids can be harmful, why glucose can be harmful. Any sort of fat ingestion in at all can also have harmful effects. So there's basically weighing out the benefits and the detriments. And on average, the benefits, I wouldn't say far outweigh, because, you know, I wouldn't have data supporting everything, but outweigh the detriments of consuming some sort of non-nutritive sweetener, especially compared to just a sugar-sweetened beverage.
Yep. Let's check off ketosis as our final topic for today. And what I'd like to do is schedule out a future podcast where we can talk about psychology and environment a little bit more. So I think that that could be its own podcast and is equally fascinating to what we've talked about today. But let's talk about ketosis. And let's talk about it in the context of the different ways you could get into ketosis and how that might differ, its impact on satiety and appetite regulation. That's it. I'm looking at my notes. Those are the two big buckets when it comes to ketosis. Let's talk about, just briefly talk about, what is a ketone, how it does the body ultimately produce and utilize it as an energy source, and then how it impacts appetite regulation.
Yeah, so a ketone is basically so in the liver we can produce lipids and glucose, and we can also break them down and utilize them as energy. And when we break down triglycerides or glucose, it's broken down into acetyl-CoA, but the enzyme required to turn acetyl-CoA into fully, basically through the citric acid cycle, into energy is also used in creating glucose in the liver, called gluconeogenesis. And when that enzyme gets used up for gluconeogenesis, we have this accumulation of acetyl-CoA inside of our liver. And these acetyl-CoAs can basically be shoved together. That's very simple, obviously, but can be utilized to create ketones in the liver. And then the liver basically releases them into the bloodstream, and different cells all throughout the body can utilize these ketones, including the brain, the heart, different cells inside throughout the body, basically. And ketones themselves can bind to receptors and alter their functioning. They just have a wildly different effects throughout the body. So there are studies looking at, you know, exogenous ketones, where they give people ketones, usually through just some sort of like liquid or something of the like. And those have physiological effects. But one of the issues with ketosis at the very beginning stages is we see a very high level of urine ketones. And this is essentially because your body can't utilize these ketones as well as someone who's been in ketosis for a year. So this puts you in almost like a low energy state, because you have this, you know, you're basically diverting your energy molecules into creating ketones, but you can't utilize those ketones effectively because you don't have an upregulation of all the enzymes required to uptake them and break them down properly. So in the beginning stages of ketones or ketosis, you lose a lot of these ketones in the urine, and that can acutely cause an increase in appetite, because a low energy state can essentially also has signaling mechanisms in the brain to increase appetite. And also, some of the ways that ketones affect appetite are by entering into cells and creating ATP. And then this energy inside of cells will release different molecules into the bloodstream that can also satiate appetite. So if you can't utilize ketones properly at the very beginning stages of ketosis, you might feel a little bit more hungry than usual. But once you get deeper and deeper into ketosis, and you've been in it for longer, so you have higher levels of ketones and you utilize them better, then those ketones can begin having an appetite suppressant effect. So this could be one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why, you know, we see when we're fasting, basically I wouldn't suggest anyone do a 7-14-day fast. I don't think it's necessary for the majority of the population. But at the very beginning, 1 to 2 days, people typically have a very high appetite. But as you know, you get deeper and deeper into ketosis and you've been in it for longer, your appetite begins to diminish a little bit. So it's almost like this prolonged response to ketosis. As you get better at utilizing ketones, their appetite suppressant effects begin to become more important, if that makes sense. And there's different appetitive responses to the beginning stages of ketosis versus long-term ketosis. And also your brain responds differently to ketones the longer it's essentially been bathed in them, if that makes sense. So the longer your brain has been introduced to ketones, the sometimes less, sometimes more. See, there's so much heterogeneity in the literature that I can't tell you a ketone is or is not satiating. But there's different responses throughout the entire body to depths of ketosis, levels of ketones, how long you've been in it, how you got to it. So if you want to discuss the ways of getting into ketosis are basically fasting or very low carbohydrate and oftentimes low protein diets if you want to get into, you know, very deep stages of ketosis. And again, those have differing effects on appetite and probably also just depends on the person as well.
Yeah, I had Martin McDonald on talk about some aggressive dieting and just some of what we see in the literature with very low calorie dieting. And it seems that on average, there seems to be an inverse correlation here a little bit. When people go on really, really low calorie diets, they actually report not a linear increase in hunger, but actually something that doesn't look like they're in a larger deficit. And that is most likely in my gut from ketosis, where maybe 3 to 5 days into a really, really, really low calorie diet, you just by the nature of really low calorie, meaning really low carbohydrate, really low energy, puts people in ketosis and seems to be where there's like, oh, after these certain amount of days, which differs, you know, based on a ton of inputs, people reach a state of ketosis and start to see a leveling off in terms of appetite, or at least not a linear increase that you would expect from, hey, the longer I'm in this large deficit, the hungrier I get in a linear fashion. It doesn't seem to play out that way. And I've seen some of the researchers in those studies and Martin himself posit that that is likely due to something having to do with ketosis and more appropriate utilization of ketones. Do you nod along with that as a potential hypothesis?
Yeah, I think even in that scenario, there's almost like a blending of ketones and glucose utilization. So you get a little bit of the effects of both. Whereas if you were in very, very therapeutic ketosis, then where it's very low protein, very low carbohydrate, and your blood glucose is basically very, very stable, if not low the entire time, there could be a differential response to that just because of excessively high ketones, but not really reasonably high glucose.
Yeah, that tracks. Anything else we want to talk about on ketosis? I want to be respectful of your time. I know you got work soon. I got to be on dad duty pretty soon. Do we want to very quickly touch on thirst? And I think the thing I would want to talk about in terms of thirst is just this idea of like, you're not hungry, you're thirsty, or you're not thirsty, you're hungry. Like this idea that they are like, you know, that you're confused. If you just drink water, then you'll be fine. Like, where is there shreds of truth within that?
So I would say there are typically a kind of sensations for hunger and for thirst come from similar areas of the brain. But a lot of times, and also, I mean, we talked already about gastric volume. Sometimes you probably are hungry, but if you drink a lot of water, it fills up your stomach. So it makes you feel like the water, you were just thirsty, if that makes sense. But a lot of times we're very good at kind of choosing or knowing between the difference between thirst and hunger. Often there are visual symptoms or physical symptoms of being thirsty, so a dry mouth. Kind of looking at a glass of water and salivating a little bit, you're probably pretty thirsty. So if you start drinking water and you're like, it kind of doesn't taste very good, then you're probably not very thirsty. If you have to put some sort of sweetener in it to make it palatable, then you're probably not very thirsty. But everyone knows if you've, you know, slept with your mouth open for a while and you wake up in the middle of the night, just all you want is water, then that's a state of thirst. So we're pretty good at kind of knowing the difference between thirst and hunger, but sometimes drinking water can suppress appetite. And there are receptors in the brain that are called osmoreceptors that can detect basically high blood osmolarity, meaning that we need more water essentially. So when we're when we need more water physiologically, we do have mechanisms to kind of increase the thirst response. And that's kind of blending into the whole appetite thing, where it's like you could have an appetite for food or for water. So that there are water appetites inside of the human body. So a lot of times if you're thirsty, then there are mechanisms to kind of drive you to seek. It could be water. It could also just be, you know, foods with high water content. So on a hot day, a lot of people are like, man, I could go for some, you know, some watermelon right now. And that could be driven by the fact that watermelon is tasty, but also because if you're a little bit dehydrated and you know that watermelon has some liquid inside of it, then that could also be a reason why you have a specific appetite for something high in water and you don't have a specific appetite for, you know, a biscuit, which has like 5% water or something of the like.
Yeah, that tracks. I want to be respectful of your time. Is there something you feel, there's a lot that we didn't cover, of course. Anything you feel like within the scope of today's chat that you feel like, hey, we glossed over, or hey, you came today hoping we'd talk about, that you feel is pressing that we want to add before we have you back for a second episode?
Not really. I would say that the psychology of appetite is so large, such a complex topic, it might need an episode by itself.
Absolutely.
And also fact check me on, I said high blood osmolarity once or twice. I'm not entirely certain if it's low or high. Someone's got to fact check me on that.
Sure.
Leave it in the comments. But, you know, I think there's so much more than just what you ate today and, you know, your body fat and things of the like that can affect your appetite, including as I have other articles completely dedicated to epigenetic changes that occur during your life and even while you are in your mother's womb that can affect the different receptors, the expression of receptors. So there's so many other things beyond just, you know, what you're eating, your body weight, that can affect your appetite, including what food you like. And there's reasons why you might have an appetite for something different than I have an appetite for. And it could be conditioned responses. So if you had a bad experience with steak one time, you might, you know, love the taste of steak, but because you have that conditioned response to the ingestion of steak and remembering that event, you might not really ever even have an appetite to consume steak. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. And there was just a paper that came out, what the mother who is pregnant eats during or while she's pregnant influence future child's taste preferences. The title was "Does Maternal Diet Influence Future Infant Taste and Odor Preferences: A Critical Analysis?" And so, you know, it's a difficult thing to study to some degree, but basically shows what you said, some of this epigenetic stuff that is certainly incredibly interesting. Yep.
Yeah. In humans, that's probably one of the most difficult randomized
control
trials.
So hard. So hard. Yeah.
So it's, and again, like, because there's such a different lifestyle component, something she did might have absolutely no impact, but because there are other things that the mother did, it might look like this one factor affected it. So I think, like you said, I think that's a podcast in and of itself.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll have you back on for the psychology stuff. Super, super fun. Appreciate your time, man. Really, you're a wealth of knowledge, and you're destined for great things. So let people know where they can find you, find your stuff. I think you do a good job on social media. I think I say this in a very endearing way. You're not good at social media. Like, and I say that in the best way possible, because you're like not interested in anything other than really helping people. And I find your content to be incredibly helpful. And if you are on that app to learn information and have it synthesized well, you are a wonderful follow. But I just crack up. I crack up because like some of the best creators are too busy being really, really, really amazing at like what they actually do. And like social media skill is just a different skill. And I say that in an endearing way. I think you do a great job. And I think if you keep doing what you're doing, it'll continue to catch on.
Yeah, I probably need to learn to edit. And I probably need to figure out some buzzwords to include in the title.
Yeah, true that.
I just love putting in I kind of just love researching and disseminating information, even though sometimes it's probably more fun for me than the people watching, but that's what it is. On most social medias, if you just look up Calvin Scheller, you'll find me. Scheller is spelled S-C-H-E-L-L-E-R. So if you look that up on social media, you should find me. And you know, I respond to, I don't have a very big following. So you send me a message and 99.9% likelihood I'll respond.
Yep. Cool, man. I appreciate your time. I'll tag you in all that stuff. And hopefully we get some people over to your page to learn a little bit. Thanks, dude.
Thanks, Jordan.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps.
If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram, @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.